Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say a few words on behalf of the College by way of introduction to this memorial occasion. Firstly, by welcoming you all, Emile's family, not least those of them who've come from France, his friends, his colleagues, both within his two Cambridge colleges and across the wider university, and his students, and also to thank Professor Nigel Slater, the President of the Senior Common Room, and Alison Carter, and other Fitzwilliam staff who have devoted so much effort to organising this particular occasion. And also to thank, of course, our speakers this evening, who David Runciman will introduce in a moment. It's not my intention to recall the tragic circumstances of almost a year ago, which bring us here this evening. Nor is this an occasion designed as a continuation of the extraordinarily moving ceremony in the Catholic Church, absolutely packed by those of us sharing in his family's grief at Emile's premature death at the age of 37. This is, above all, I hope, an occasion not to lament his disappearance, but rather to perpetuate his memory. The College itself, to that end, established in perpetuity the Emile Perrault-Saucine Academic Prize. And the recent letter we've had from its first holder, recalling his first ever supervision with Emile — this particular bright student is now doing a PhD in London — talked of how deeply honoured he was to have received that particular named prize. And his letter gives a sense, more generally, of Emile as a teacher and his formative influence on the next generation, and of his demanding standards and intellectually inspiring interchanges with undergraduates. Within the College, it should be added, he was not only director of studies in political science, but had also recently enlarged his contribution to the life and work of Fitzwilliam by becoming a tutor, which, as many of you will know, is a job for the empathetic, the sympathetic, and for those endowed with the gift of patience. But to look, if you will, at the handout — and I don't intend to read it out, but I do commend it to you — and if you can identify in the photographs Madame Chirac awarding Emile the prestigious Philippe Habert Prize in 1995, to look at that handout is also to get a sense of Emile's growing reputation as an academic in the books and articles which are the creative and lasting result of his thinking, enriched by the singular way, I think exploiting what is best about Cambridge, enriched by the way in which he reached across disciplines, discourses, and faculty boundaries to engage with others in developing that serious thinking. To evoke that seriousness is not in any way to qualify his loving commitment to his family, his personal warmth, or the British sense of irony, which, as I know from my own conversations with him in French, he had gradually assimilated during his career on this side of the Channel. But it's also true to say that in the best traditions of France, where the term was invented, or at least given public currency at the end of the 19th century, and remains even today one of distinction, which commands respect, within that tradition, Emile was an intellectual. And this evening's occasion, in its conception and design, is both a tribute to his professional life and confirmation that his voice is still heard and that we shall not forget. David.
To briefly introduce our three speakers, who will each speak for around a quarter of an hour, so we hope we'll have plenty of time for discussion afterwards. Christopher Brooke, who is, like me, from the Department of Politics and International Studies, also a fellow of King's College, who writes and teaches in the history of modern political thought across the full range, like Emile, a huge range. He has a book forthcoming with Princeton University Press on Stoicism in 17th and 18th century political thought. He is writing a biography of Rousseau and is also working on a book about distributive justice. And he's also the author of a hugely enjoyable and interesting blog about politics, history, and the history of ideas called The Virtual Stoa, that I recommend. Richard Rex from the Faculty of Divinity, also a fellow of Queen's College, who is an expert in the thought and the politics of the early modern period in England and in Europe. He is the author of very well-known books about the Tudors, about Henry VIII and the English Reformation. And he is also a translator of academic works from French into English. And he is the translator of Emile's recently published work on Catholicism and democracy, that is recently published in its original French. And Richard's English translation is going to be published by Princeton University Press early next year. And Philippe Delara, who is from the Panthéon Assas University in Paris, who has written widely on modern thought. He has published a book on Charles Taylor, who, along with Alistair MacIntyre, the subject of Emile's great book, is one of the central figures in thinking about the role of religion and politics, morality and secularism in the modern age. Philippe has also published books on Wittgenstein, and in May he will be bringing out a major study of the origins of totalitarianism. So those are our three speakers, and I'll invite Chris to speak first.
My remarks tonight carry the title, Why Secular Liberals Need Roman Catholics, and then in brackets, and Marxists. So that's the conclusion I'm going to reach in about 15 minutes' time. And I'm going to get there by way of a brief discussion of the religious crisis of the French Revolution of 1789 and the modern political ideological traditions, socialism, conservatism, and liberalism, all of which owe their origins to as different kinds of reaction to the revolution in the early part of the 19th century. But first, I want to say something about Emile Perrault-Saussine, and then about the character of scholarship on the history of political thought here at Cambridge. And I'll make my way to the question of the French political tradition from there. So that's just a brief map to orient you before I really get going. I didn't know Emile Perrault-Saussine well, and I didn't know him for long. I arrived in Cambridge to teach in the politics department in October 2009, and so Emile was, all too briefly, my colleague. And he was a good colleague, both in our departmental life together and outside it. In particular, I have very fond memories of an evening here at Fitzwilliam for dinner that Michaelmas term, when Emile was very proud to show me around, including and especially the very fine oak and concrete college chapel. But what I remember above all from that evening, and many people will remember this above all about Emile, was his delightful conversation. We found so many things to talk about, from our experiences of academic life in the United States to the present state of the European left to, of course, the political thought of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And while I think it was very clear that we were never going to agree about many things, I had a very strong sense that this couldn't and that it wouldn't matter at all. I wanted to reciprocate his hospitality, to have him over to dine at King's in the following term, above all, to continue the conversation. I would have loved, for example, to have discussed the books of Alistair MacIntyre with Emile, which have meant even more to him over the years than they have done to me. But Emile's shocking sudden death around this time last year meant that I was never able to return his invitation, and the debts that weigh on us the most are the ones we know we can never repay. One of the greatest films ever made, Casablanca, ends with the famous line delivered to a Frenchman that I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. That is all that Emile and I could enjoy, a beginning. Fate intervened, Emile died young, far too young, and that's why we're all here today. Now, I only came to Cambridge, as I said, a little over a year ago, and from the outside, I'd always thought that the history of political thought here was a strikingly secular affair. The second volume of Professor Quentin Skinner's 1978 book, The Foundations of Modern Political Thought, carries the subtitle The Age of Reformation, but it really doesn't seem to me to have much to do with religion, or as much to do with religion as that subtitle might indicate. And another great figure in the Cambridge tradition, my own PhD supervisor Richard Tuck, who was in Cambridge for a quarter of a century before he migrated to the other Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is where he taught me. Although Richard once spectacularly tried to explain the Arminian theory of grace by means of a parable involving a parent offering to buy an ice cream for his or her child, Richard was one of those people for whom it was just obvious that religion was nonsense, an irrational anthropological curiosity, but not much more. I can remember a very funny seminar at Harvard one time where those of us in the room who had first-hand experience of the Church of England had no difficulty at all understanding the very famous description of Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan as a farrago of Christian atheism, which some of the Americans present seemed to think was a contradiction in terms. As the joke goes, the best thing about the Church of England is that you can believe anything at all, but the worst thing is that nobody does. So my sense of the Cambridge tradition in the history of political thought from the outside, as I say, was that the world of history and politics here was thoroughly non-religious. And in light of that thought, it seemed to me to reflect very well on Cambridge and very well on Emile, who, of course, took his Catholicism very seriously, that he seemed to like it so much here and to do so well. But if Cambridge scholars like Quentin Skinner and Richard Tuck were surprising in their largely secular approach to the thought of a largely religious age, there were also historians of political thought here in Cambridge who have in recent years been moving in the opposite direction, re-injecting religious content into a historiography that had, to a considerable extent, been trying to do without it. Gareth Stedman Jones has recently retired as Professor of Political Science, and in the volume on religion and the political imagination, which he co-edited and to which Emile contributed an excellent chapter on ultramontanism in post-revolutionary France, in that book, in the introduction, we find this suggestion, and I'll read a short passage from the introduction. The equation of the French Revolution with modernity makes it easy to forget that the years between 1789 and 1802 could be viewed as the last in a series of reformations and religious wars, which had rent Europe apart since the beginning of the 16th century. Looked at that way, and many contemporaries, both inside and outside France, did look at it that way, the revolution could equally be viewed as a failed reformation. And if you take that perspective seriously, the repercussions of the religious crisis of the French Revolution can be seen wherever one looks. Gareth concluded the introduction to a different book, his magnificent edition of the French utopian socialist Charles Fourier's 1808 book, The Theory of the Four Movements, for example. This is the book that says that under socialism, the Arctic Ocean won't just turn to lemonade, it will turn to a particular brand of lemonade, and that whales will learn to pull ships. It's this magnificent book. In the introduction to this book, Gareth notes that he says that conventional scholarship still tends to attribute the origins of socialism to a heightened concern for equality arising from the French Revolution and to the consequences of industrialization. But in fact, this book, Fourier's book, is most immediately a reminder that the French Revolution had involved not only the transformation of the state, but also the attempt to replace the church. Fourier's economic criticism, he concludes, so influential in shaping the subsequent socialist tradition, began in this context. The Theory of the Four Movements is a reminder that socialism began as an attempt to discover a successor not to capitalism, but to the Christian church. Well, if the socialisms of Fourier and also of his fellow utopian socialist, the Comte de Saint-Simon, began with religious concerns at their core, and if the distinctive throne and altar conservatism of the fearful reactionary Joseph de Maistre is obviously and obsessively also religious, then what we might ask of French liberalism, which also took distinctive shape during exactly the same period, around a decade after the Revolution of 1789. Well, recently we've had Helena Rosenblatt, who teaches at Hunter College in New York, publishing a study of everybody's favourite French liberal, Benjamin Constant. She's published a book called Liberal Values, in which she tries to restore to the hitherto largely secular Constant of the existing, especially English language scholarship, to restore his abiding concern with religion that culminated in his five-volume study, De la Religion, which began to appear right at the end of his life. Without religion, Constant thought, all we had to fall back on was a psychology of self-interest that could produce only a society of what he called industrious beavers, whereas in a genuinely moral society, we needed to be drawn out of ourselves. And it was our religious sentiment, Constant thought, which enabled this to happen, making possible the right kind of disinterested behaviour. And at the start of the current academic year, Professor Rosenblatt visited the Monday research seminar that meets every Monday at King's here in Cambridge, which I convene alongside John Robertson, Gareth Stedman-Jones' successor in the chair here. And to continue the theme about religion, John has a very exciting project about the writing of sacred history in the age of the Enlightenment that again complicates familiar and rather flat narratives of secularization. But Professor Rosenblatt came to our seminar and gave a paper about the hopes that various French liberals had well into the 19th century for a Protestant Reformation in that country. Napoleon Bonaparte had even held discussions with his advisors on this question of whether to try to have a state-sponsored Protestant Reformation in France, before instead he agreed to the Concordat in 1801 with the Pope, which was the occasion for the official reintroduction of Catholicism to France after the Revolution. And of course, the most famous 19th century example of a French liberal's deep interest in the social and political consequences of Protestantism is on display in Alexis de Tocqueville's classic study of democracy in America. Well, why do we find this concern with religion everywhere we look across the ideological politics of the early 19th century? One classic theme in the Cambridge historiography of political thought, it's central to the work of both Richard Tuck, whom I mentioned a moment ago, and also of my King's colleague István Hont, concerns human sociability, the question of how naturally diffident human beings can be fitted to live alongside one another in more or less harmonious fashion. If the 17th century political, if the 17th century political authoritarianism of Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, or the small-scale republics of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's 18th century political imagination become implausible or unattractive visions of modern life, then three obvious places to look for sources of social cohesion were, first, political economy, although the market seems to generate antagonism and class struggle as much as self-sustaining and self-reproducing patterns of integration and interdependence. Second, people have explored nationalism, although this has been known to cause a few problems of its own. Or third, they've sometimes turned to religion. And we get that in the Constant remark about beavers and why a society of beavers isn't enough. And Rousseau himself explored, placed emphasis on the matter of religion in the penultimate chapter of his great book, The Social Contract, where he argued that those who act as if they do not subscribe to the dogmas of what he calls the purely civil profession of faith should be banished for the state, he says, not for being impious, but for being unsociable. So if we stick with liberalism and broaden the discussion a bit, we can ask the question, Is liberalism a kind of disguised, or perhaps even not so disguised, Protestantism? From the right, 200 years ago, Joseph de Maistre, whom I mentioned a moment ago, denounced liberalism. He said it was political Protestantism carried to the most absolute individualism. That, for him, was a very bad thing. From the left, far more recently, my Cambridge colleague in the philosophy faculty, Raymond Geuss, has been associated with the view that the influential American political philosopher John Rawls's so-called political liberalism is a kind of only half-secularized Protestant Christianity. And the recent publication of Rawls's undergraduate dissertation from Princeton, written at the outbreak of the Second World War, on mid-century Protestant notions of sin, makes this interpretation, I think, biographically quite plausible. Many people today still insist, quite anachronistically, that John Locke was one of the most important liberal theorists of them all, and it was the achievement of John Donne, a very senior colleague of mine from King's, to demonstrate early in his career in the 1960s, in his book on Locke, how inseparable Locke's political ideas were from a particular version of Protestant theology. And we might also reflect that much liberal discourse looks pretty religious, substituting notions of rationality, of reasonableness, and of human rights for the place formerly occupied by God. In my own scholarly work right now, as David mentioned, I'm trying to write a history of liberal ideas about distributive justice over the last 150 years or so. That's the question of how stuff ought to be divided up in a particular political community. And I'm repeatedly struck by the way in which two distinct justice traditions seem to develop in parallel to one another over more or less the same period. On the one hand, there's the liberal theory of distributive justice, ostensibly secular and with a political economy inflection, being thrashed out in the traditionally Protestant, often Anglophone, countries. On the other hand, there's the Roman Catholic social teaching, which underpins the politics of post-war Christian democracy in Europe, for example. And some key dates stand out. 1891, for example, is the date, it's when the first edition of Henry Sidgwick's book, The Elements of Politics, came out. It's also the date, it's the year that Pope Leo XII issued his encyclical Rerum Novarum, with its subtitle On Capital and Labour, which is the key document, it's the founding document of the Catholic social teaching tradition. And 1971, 80 years later, saw the appearance of both John Rawls's Theory of Justice, the book that has loomed large over the thinking of many liberal political philosophers over the last four decades, as well as of two key documents of the Catholic social teaching, the Apostolic Letter of Pope Paul VI, Octogesima Adveniens, that's referring back to Rerum Novarum after 80 years, also called A Call to Action, and the declaration of the Synod of Bishops, Justitia in Mundo. So we have this persistent ambiguity, which seems to me impossible to resolve, about whether liberalism is best understood as a secular or as a religious, historical, and philosophical tradition. And just as the awkward and ambiguous relationship obtains between liberalism and capitalism means that just this relationship means that those of us who are secular liberals, more or less, teaching in more or less secular liberal universities, well, it means we badly need to have Marxists taking part in our ongoing conversations, Marxists who orient their own thinking around the decisive rejection of the present socioeconomic order. So too, it seems to me, that the similarly awkward and ambiguous relationship between liberalism and Protestantism means that we also badly need to have seriously Roman Catholic intellectuals in our midst too. Scholars like Alistair MacIntyre, who was himself once also a Marxist, or like our friend Émile Perrault-Saussine. Well, to conclude, before I sat down to write these remarks, I emailed an American student who studied last year in Cambridge, both with me and with Emile, about what it was like to be supervised by him. The mix of passion and seriousness is what I would highlight the most, Alice Gissinger wrote back to me. He gave me guidance, comments, inspiration, with such a gift for imparting the love of his subject. In just a few weeks, he had sent me to the Rare Books Room, shared 100 bibliographical references, shown me my way through the stakes and rhetoric of the 1905 French separation of church and state, with such grace, insight, and conviction that I left my first supervision with him, knowing that this would become the subject for my senior thesis. I remember, too, a habit Emile had at the beginning of every supervision, eyebrows arching a little, leaning back in his chair, as if he was worried. He would ask, "Ça vous a plu? Did you like it?" He meant to ask whether the prodigious reading list of the latest week had been to my liking, whether he had hit the right note to stir his students' intellect. He should have known that he always did. Thank you all very much.
It's with some trepidation that I begin, as my credentials for being here are those of a historian and a translator, not those of a political philosopher. And if, as Dr. Johnson once said, in the historian, all the greatest powers of the human mind are dormant, he had a still lower opinion, which I won't repeat, on translators. Emile Perrault-Saucine identified himself as a political philosopher, placing himself squarely in the tradition of Plato, by avowing a profound and abiding interest in the relationship between the city and the soul. In the interaction, as he explained that pairing, of politics, morality, and religion. In his forthcoming book, Catholicism and Democracy, which I know reasonably well, he addressed these issues in his distinctive way and on a typically broad canvas. Catholicism and Democracy was meant to be the first case study in a series of analyses that would address a general problem posed, as Christopher has already indicated, by the emergence of the modern state in the wake of the Enlightenment and the Revolution. What is the place of religion in politics, and indeed in the public sphere, now that the modern secular state has emancipated itself from the matrix of the confessional state within which it first took shape? It's been obvious since the 1790s that this was a problem for religion. Much of Catholicism and Democracy is therefore taken up with the Catholic Church's protracted and troubled process of adjustment to secular political modernity, a process which reached its theoretical or theological conclusion at the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s with the Declaration on Religious Liberty and the pastoral constitution Gaudium et Spes on the Church in the Modern World. However, one of Emile's insights or contentions was that the position of religion in the modern state is also a problem for political society. Not, I should add, a problem in the 9/11 sense. That is, in the sense that religion, or a specific religion, is as such purely and simply a problem. The challenges posed by Islamist terrorism are no different in kind from those posed by other, usually secular, ideologies of terror. Terrorism has been, if not endemic, then at least recurrent in Western culture since the end of the 19th century, since the effective secularization of European intellectual culture, that cultural chasm of the 1890s. Emile, though, was particularly struck by the fact that the oldest of the world's democracies, the United States of America, is not only the strongest of them, but also, as is often noted with a certain incredulity in Britain today, the most religious. He was struck equally by the fact that this was already apparent to one of the earliest and most thoughtful commentators on American democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville. What may surprise you, well, probably not because you're all philosophers, is that Tocqueville saw the powerful role of religion in America as a blessing. For as Emile reads him, Tocqueville saw religion as a solution, perhaps the solution, to the problem of state power in the era of mass politics. That problem, the problem of power, was the threat of majority power to minority freedom, and thus, in effect, to all freedom. What could restrain a ruler as powerful as the people? Only some spiritual power. The particular problem in the old world, as opposed to the new world, was the collapse of spiritual power in the wake of the French Revolution. The churches had been too much a part of the ancien regime, and their social power, even their spiritual power, had therefore crumbled when the foundations of that regime were shaken. For Émile, the thinkers who saw this problem most clearly were Joseph de Maistre and Auguste Comte. Maistre was the intellectual inspiration of Catholic reaction and counter-revolution, and his attempt to rescue spiritual power resulted in the forging of a new kind of Catholicism, militant ultramontanism, an attempt to reconstruct the industrial world in the image of a Middle Ages that had, of course, never existed, a Gothic, romantic paradise of Christian order. Maitrean ultramontanism could perhaps be regarded as the first modern fundamentalism. Comte, however, a generation or so later, concluded that Maitre had backed the wrong horse. In place of Catholicism, which Comte saw as superannuated by the Enlightenment, he proposed in the 1840s to fill the vacuum of spiritual power by founding a new religion, the Religion of Humanity, one of several of that name since that time. Although his solution now seems merely quaint, one can forget that successful new religions can still be founded. Mormonism, which originated in America at much the same time as the Religion of Humanity in France, was one such. And for a generation, Comtean thought held sway in liberal France and was almost the guiding ideology of the Third Republic. Maitre and Comte are largely forgotten today, except perhaps by professional political thinkers, but the problem they identified has not gone away. It has continued to be remarked upon, not only by commentators from religious perspectives, but also, though less often, by those from secular perspectives. It was famously summed up by the Catholic jurist Ernst Wolfgang Buchenforder, if I've got his name right, who contended in 1967 that the liberal secular state lives on premises that it cannot itself guarantee. On the one hand, it can subsist only if the freedom it concedes to its citizens is regulated from within, inside the moral substance of individuals and of a homogeneous society. On the other hand, it is not able to guarantee these forces of inner regulation by itself without renouncing its own liberalism. Very recently, that last giant of the Enlightenment, Jürgen Habermas, has taken up Buchenforder's challenge in an interesting exchange with Joseph Ratzinger, now better known, of course, as Benedict XVI, that took place at Munich early in 2004. Habermas's engagement with Buchenforder, however, shows how difficult it is for Western secular rationality, or reason, as it's sometimes called, to grapple with both the theological and the postmodern critiques of its own positions. And this, in turn, tends to confirm, I would argue, the diagnosis which has been offered by shrewd physicians of the body politic from the time of Maitre onwards. Habermas begins, very interestingly, by agreeing that Buchenforder's diagnosis cannot simply be dismissed out of hand. But he does not want to let that give heart to the defenders of religion, in case they end up using it as an argument to draw people back towards faith. However, his capacity to meet the challenge to the relativistic tendencies of reason is distinctly limited. He reports a comment made to him by a fellow scholar to the effect that European secularization is beginning to look like an anomaly in need of correction. Yet his response, interesting in, as it were, two ways, is to liken this opinion to the anomie of Weimar Germany, as exemplified for him in the writings of Heidegger, Carl Schmitt, and Leo Strauss. But his rather dodgy conclusion is simply that we shouldn't push the question too far. As an historian of the Reformation, I'm reminded by this of Calvin's prohibition on pushing too far the question of how to reconcile predestination with the justice and goodness of God. Now, both these responses are perfectly understandable. They make sense, but they're not reasonable, which was fine for Calvin, who subordinated reason to revelation, but perhaps not for Habermas, the last of the apostles of reason. Who is Habermas to tell us when to stop asking questions? The most revealing observation he makes, however, is that political virtues are essential if democracy is to survive. Where he differs from Buchenforder and Tocqueville is in his confidence, for which I see little evidence, that liberal democracies are indeed able to generate, transmit, and perpetuate these virtues from their own resources. They've been trying this for a while now, though admittedly not very long. Some would say it's not going too well. Why Habermas's observation interests me again, in particular as an historian of the early modern era, is that in the political thought of the Renaissance humanists, as in that of their medieval scholastic predecessors, the same basic problem was detected in the dominant political system of their time. Monarchy. Monarchy, of course, has many advantages. It provides clear and decisive leadership and a personal focus of loyalty. But it has one big problem. What if the king goes off the rails? What can you do to minimize that risk? The only answer anyone ever came up with was education. The institution of a Christian prince to take the title of Erasmus's exemplary contribution to the literary genre was all about initiating the future ruler in childhood and youth into the practice of Christian morality, of the cardinal and theological virtues, in the pious hope that this would impose some internal spiritual constraint on a power which, by definition, could not be subject to external constraint. Did it work? Perhaps not. Excuse me, could I have my glass of water, actually? That's better. The solution to modernity seemed clear. Regime change, the replacement of monarchy by a new system of government, which of itself would safeguard order, justice, and liberty. The idea that if the system is well designed, it will be proof against the darkness of the human heart is a recurrent delusion, one to which our own age is peculiarly prone. In our lifetimes, it's begotten the culture of the ticked box. It is so much easier to guarantee the right procedures than the right outcomes. Yet the best theorists of republican government, Machiavelli, Rousseau, like the best theorists of monarchical government, have seen all too clearly that the key in both systems is in fact the same, virtue. Republics need good citizens. Republics, in short, as G.K. Chesterton once pointed out, need republicans. Without virtue, without active, vigorous, and respected virtues, no citizens, no republic, no common good. Yet where, to quote Habermas again, shall we find virtue amidst what he calls the ethical abstinence of a post-metaphysical thinking, to which every universally obligatory concept of a good and exemplary life is alien? This is where religious and also non-religious groups come in. Catholics and Marxists, as it were. Ethical views and values can only be generated, formulated, transmitted, lived, and died for within social groups loyal to something greater than each, greater than all, greater even than the state. There's an arguably on all of those, of course. Such groups can no longer be coterminous with the state in an age of freedom, but they must be substantial and secure enough to maintain a discernible position in society. Émile, developing Tocqueville's analysis, would argue that the modern state, while, as in the United States, maintaining strict neutrality between religions, as long as and as far as their activities remain within the law, should equally permit and even in some ways encourage such groups. Partly because of the need which even republicans acknowledge for the cultivation of virtue among the citizens, but partly also in proper political humility, out of the realization that lawfully flourishing religious groups are among the most durable forces in the face of that perennial temptation of the state, the temptation to arrogate to itself excessive power, a temptation to which there is no particular reason to believe that the liberal democratic state is immune. As present circumstances, I think, all too clearly demonstrate. Historically, it is no accident that Western liberalism and the secular state emerged from the politico-religious matrix of medieval church-state rivalry and the later division of Europe into Protestant and Catholic. Habermas himself is happy to recognize the place of Christian theology in the genealogy of human rights, though again, characteristically, he won't let Christians get too cocky about that. But during the religious turn, if we can call it that, of the late 20th century, We saw Catholicism provide a social framework within which opposition to Polish communism could coalesce. And we saw Islam provide a similar framework with which Afghanistan could throw back a Russian invasion. States need strong religious groups to help protect citizens against the state itself, and perhaps also against themselves. Equally, of course, we have seen in some Catholic countries, notably Ireland, an institutional obliviousness towards horrifying abuse arising out of an excessive deference to spiritual power. We must be careful about it. In some Muslim countries, we see ferocious persecution of non-Muslims or of wrong Muslims through the implementation of Sharia law. There is no doubt, equally, that religious groups need a strong and neutral state to protect them from each other, from themselves, in particular one often feels from their leaders, and not to mention to protect society from the abuse of spiritual power. It's a delicate balance. Emil certainly did not want to see the state return to making binding judgments between competing claims to truth. The state's antennae, as he says in the book, are simply not tuned to that wavelength. Still less, however, did he want to see the secular state aspire to the sort of control over religion and indeed society that was taken for granted in the confessional state. That, for him, was the hubris of the civil constitution of the clergy, which brought Nemesis, in the form of Napoleon, upon the French Revolution. Just as bad was the endeavour of the liberal states 100 years ago to displace religion by main force from its social position. Another version of that endeavour stretches its shadow over the modern state today, in the imposition by the state of a specific moral code upon the public sphere, and the drive to exclude from the public sphere anybody who refuses full assent to that code, which is widely confused with liberalism, but is not in any sense identical with it. This is a political version of the confessional secularism which Brad Gregory has detected at work in the American Academy, where, for example, Tor Egil Furland has argued for the exclusion of religious believers from academic work in universities. One might compare the suggestion by a professor of this university that Christian belief disqualifies its adherents from thinking about moral issues, and his call for them to get back on their knees where they should be. A clarion call for exclusion from the public sphere. Emil was a true liberal, taking liberalism as a system which leaves room in the state for those who do not think or feel in every way as the majority does. At the moment, to conclude, it is religion alone which prophetically reminds the majority that not everyone thinks the same way about everything.
Well, let me apologize first for my poor English. Emil's death is a tragedy for his family and all those who loved him, but it's also a tragic loss for philosophy. We have carried on an ongoing conversation for 15 years, mainly on political and social philosophy. His faith and his belonging to the Catholic Church was a central fact of his life and thought. I'm a secular Jew, and I might adopt the view Wittgenstein once expressed to a friend: I'm not a religious man, but I cannot help seeing any problem from a religious point of view. So we had a common standpoint in taking religion seriously, but in extremely different ways. Therefore, our conversation on religion was relaxed, open, and yet restrained, discreet, I would say, in the sense that none of us ever tried in any way to convince the other of anything. Contrarywise to our discussions about social and political theory, primitive society, or about the assessment of Alasdair MacIntyre and Charles Taylor's compared merits, then we could have endless arguments. Today I would like to say a few words about his last finished book, Catholicism et Démocratie, so just published in French and forthcoming in English. The issue at stake in the book is a classical one, and it's addressed to, in a rather straightforward way. Is there a significant place for a religious institution like the church in a secular age? And what can be then the meaning and function of such an institution? These questions are answered by Emile, not by asserted claims, but through a historical narrative about how the Catholic Church has been dealing with the modern democratic world, that is, for the last two centuries. This issue must not be understood as about faith or about the plausibility of this or that belief or maxim, but about the possibility and significance of a living and organized community. Let me say boldly, the issue is about the social fact of the church. But of course, there's a strong other claim underlying, and I would say feeding, this question. The idea that a society without religion or without religious authority, let us assume this is a sound description of what democratic and liberal societies intend to be, well, such an idea, according to Emile, is at least unsatisfactory, probably non-consistent, and maybe dangerous. What is called secularization does not consist in getting rid of religion, be it by its disappearance, or its becoming a strictly private matter, or through a kind of mitigation and trivialization, in the sense Chesterton put it when he said, the world nowadays is full of ancient Christian virtues which became mad. I'm sorry if I misquote, but I don't know the original. I translate from the French this very famous motto of Chesterton, which, by the way, is often wrongly quoted in French as full of ideas, which was it's in fact ancient Christian virtues and not Christian ideas. So I would like to highlight first some features of Emile's style, of his tone of voice, because it may be a good way to get to the substance of his intentions. Many, if not most, of the great modern Catholic writers who addressed these issues could be labeled as of the imprecatory style. To my opinion, the greatest among them is a Briton, Gilbert Chesterton, but we French put up a good show with Bernanos, and more recently, the late Philippe Muret. Emile shares a lot with this tradition. His wit, his ironic perception, and instinctual diffidence and distance towards contemporary mores and values, sometimes ferocious, but without hatred. Yet, he is by no means of the imprecatory type. All the opposite. His voice is dispassionate and confident. One will think this was his character, liberal, lively, optimistic, and of course he was. It's almost impossible to imagine Emile in anger. Yet, there is a paradox, and a paradox I'm sure he cultivated consciously in his recasting, if I may say so, a painful story full of dissent, full of bitterness inside and outside of the church, in a rather peaceful narrative. He speaks in an even, if not friendly, way of nearly all the actors of this story, including the French revolutionaries who tried to introduce the Constitution civile du clergé. But in the end, his refusal of the unreligious understanding of human freedom, of the idea that autonomy, that's the liberal idea of freedom, is self-contained. So this refusal of this idea by Emile is as firm, and I would say as stubborn by him, as that of the imprecators, only that he doesn't pump up the volume. He seems to convert almost naturally the Catholic feeling of alienation towards modernity into a positive leverage in the liberal world. This is by no means the confidence of a dogmatic shepherd knowing with certainty where to lead his flock. His confidence was rather in the idea that his doubts and quests as a Catholic would be audible and significant for outsiders. There is no doubt in his mind that any reader can be interested and affected by the issue, whatever its faith or absence of faith. Therefore, the somehow surprising subtitle of the book, so Catholicism et Démocratie, a history of political thought, no less. One could find here a certain conceit. Using such a phrase, I believe, is part of Emile's sense of humor. But he means it for real. He strongly insists that liberalism cannot escape not only the religious, but also the churchly dimension, if I may say so, of human condition. One doesn't have to agree with this conception of the centrality of the church for modern politics to acknowledge a great achievement in it. And first of all, the ability, Emile's ability, to speak at the same time for the inside and for the outside, to involve its reader in matters and conflict belonging to the history of the Catholic Church. This not, of course, by pretending, what some people do sometimes, that everybody is or should be Catholic, but on the contrary, by modestly inviting the non-members, that is the majority today, to pay attention to what happens in the club. And I think this is extremely important in Emile's thought and style, not only as a position, but I'd like to say something he practiced and he invited us to practice as an experiment. It's not something he claims, it's something he does in his work. So one could sum up the book by saying that it favors a kind of liberal ultramontanism, which makes sense of Catholicism, again, as a social fact and not only as a faith, as a personal faith, in the modern conditions of the separation of church and state and of religious freedom. City of man is made of the various nations. The city of God has to be distinct, even distant, and therefore organized in its proper form and space. The church has lost and cannot claim for any inner authority within nations, but it has gained an outer, if I may say so, authority, maybe higher and more authentic, thanks to and not despite religious freedom and separation of churches and state. So it's possible to state things like that, but it would be unfair to Emile's spirit to put it like this. First, because his book is mostly a narrative, as I said, and second, because nothing is asserted in this book without qualifications. Emile is in fact dealing with two ideas he does not pretend to unite easily, to say the least. First, a Tocqueville-based idea of the need for some unifying pouvoir spirituel in a democratic, that is, individualistic society. The idea that liberal freedom needs education, that atomism must be reunited somehow. And second, an Augustine-based sense of the distinction between the two cities. What is then the city of God? What is the church, if not anymore, a political body? Emile is confident in the possibility of a felicitous harmony between the church as an institution and liberal society, but at the same time is worried about its appropriate form, which can be neither the iron of a kind of a state apparatus, nor the elusive ether of inner religion. When he tells the story of balance and conflicts in history between Gallicanism and Ultramontanism, under their various versions, he stresses that every position has had its logic and its point, each of them its flaws and even dangers. He is neither a Pope-centered Catholic fighting against the idea of national autonomy of churches, nor the opposite, because neither the first view nor the second are solutions as such, but rather branches of a quest for a solution. This seems rather paradoxical given the fierceness of this opposition in history and still nowadays. Here is, I believe, Emile's basic contention. C'est peut-être la dépendance à l'égard du divin qui, en tempérant la tyrannie de la majorité, rend possible la liberté politique. La vie religieuse peut aller de pair avec une sagesse que la vie démocratique ne produit pas d'elle-même. Une sagesse qui passe par la conscience des limites de l'autonomie humaine. Maybe only the dependence on the divine can allow for political freedom by moderating the tyranny of the majority. Religious life can go along with some kind of wisdom that democratic life cannot produce by itself, a wisdom aware of the limits of human autonomy. But such a belief is in by no way a political guideline for the church. It's rather a puzzle, an unanswered question. What could be, nowadays, an institution faithful to this view of the dependence on the divine? And if I'm right, if I understand Emil correctly, the most significant figure in the book is perhaps Lamennais, to that extent, who precisely did not promote always the same conception of Catholicism during his life and bridged various and deeply opposed trends among Catholics, from the priority of the allegiance to the Pope to the foundation of Catholic socialism and including other positions or ideas inspired by Lamennais. Lamennais searched restlessly a third path beyond clerical hierarchy and beyond liberal individualism. And he was influential by this search more than by his findings. I shall conclude by suggesting that Emil's book is important in that it could be considered at the beginning or the outline of a new way of dealing with the issues of religion and democracy, a way which understands, and I would say is responsive to, the end of the conflicting period of secularization, a way I would qualify as relaxed and yet anxious and demanding, likewise our conversation. Otherwise put, I believe that his style in reconstructing the history of Catholic politics in modern times is not only personal and provocative, but very relevant. I had written quite relevant, but I've been told that quite is a quite difficult word to manipulate in English. So I said and meant very relevant for the present moment of democratic experience, with this central feature that the fightings against and around secularization are behind us. No doubt, he would have extended his insight, this central insight, to further inquiries, perhaps on Christians in politics, or on civil religion, or on what is called inter-religious dialogue. Who knows? We shall have to continue the conversation by ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our three speakers. We've got a little bit more than 20 minutes for discussion. So maybe if we could take two or three comments or questions from the audience and then we could return to the panel. It's a bit dark because it's quite bright up here. So wave. Any comments or questions?
I think the talks have opened up a wonderful debate. I'm slightly interested in the confessional movements that actually took place in the late 19th century, early 20th century. I'm thinking of the impact of the later Tolstoy in Russia, or of Abraham Kuyper and the Anti-Revolutionary Party and its dominance in the Netherlands, or even in England, of Keir Hardie and Tawney, people like that who were overtly confessional in their understanding of socialism. It seems to me that these have often been marginalised in the assumption that somehow or other there's a largely secular debate that's going on in all of these. And another related question is that often the secularisation thesis ignores the fact that fascism, that state socialism, that capitalism, the failures, if you like, of modernism are also part of the secular mix, as are the liberal traditions. And we might add to those the modern subjective consumerist approach to politics. It's also creating a lot of problems. So it seems to me that maybe the secular debate hasn't been stated clearly in terms of the overall impact of secularism on modernism, and also the confessional content of Catholic and Protestant traditions is much stronger than is often acknowledged.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other questions or comments before we...
Yes,
sir. Yes.
Yes. In your own remarks, David, reading the room for the place, or some prefer Plato's context. And I think one of the things that I most enjoyed talking to you about was what I know about Plato up to a point, well, not really immutable, just invested. And I think that's very interesting in the Cambridge context, or the kind of character of the way that it was done in Cambridge. And of course, there are lots of different views you can take about the contribution of a particular thinker to a tradition of political thought. But, I mean, Aiming was 100% for, I think, for it being the dialogue across the centuries. I mean, that has not always been popular in Cambridge, but he was a paid-up subscriber to that, and I think the talks that we've had this evening, I mean, you can hear, you can hear the echo as well, certainly, for the City of God and the City of Man. You can hear the and somebody talked about the City of the Soul. These preoccupations were many all the time, and you never quite knew which century you were talking about.
Would you like to respond to either of those?
I mean, just on political philosophy as a conversation across the centuries, I'm not sure I'm 100% for that view, but it's just true that when you read a lot of the canonical political philosophers and look at who they're talking about, they are referring not to their own contemporaries, but to what we might think of as canonical authorities. Rousseau's Social Contract begins with criticisms directed against Aristotle, criticisms directed against Grotius. You know, the big names for him are often the same names as the big names for us. But what I would always want to insist on is that the questions aren't always the same, that when people in the 17th century and in the 18th century are reading and reflecting and arguing about Augustine, it's not that the same questions recur in the same way for each generation. Embedded in different times and places, when people turn back to the same texts, they find different problems there, they find different things to wrestle with. So in Cambridge we like reducing things to contexts, but there are lots of different contexts. You can cut the cake in a lot of different ways. And yes, a lot of these people are taking very seriously, trying to orient their thought in relation to great names from the past. So, yes, in some ways, a dialogue across the centuries, but the texts, the great texts, always look a bit different as you move as you move through the ages and from place to place.
I would like to react to the first question. If I understood it correctly, it was a remark rather than a question, which is a problem in Emile's book, which makes it even more tragic that it will not have a sequel, but at least written by him, because there is a big issue here. It's the fact that, especially in the 20th century, the need for transcendence, or to speak in an Augustinian way, of love for a common object among men as building and cementing a society has not to be necessarily religious and recognized as such. And there is, and I think that the some kind of a concept of secular religion, referring to things like fascism, communism, Nazism, and assuming they had a kind of religious dimension, is inescapable. That is, the modernity, the direct modernity, is not between secularization and religions, but there is, so to speak, a third term. And I won't make a long argument on this immensely difficult subject, just tell an anecdote about Emile, because concerned our last work together. He took part to a conference I organized on totalitarianism, and he presented, his job was to present an Hungarian writer, Aurel Kolnai, on which he did, as usual, a very good, very clear and going straight to the point at the conference. And then, after discussing together, we decided, and I think he decided, to withdraw his paper because he was not quite happy, not with him, but with Aurel Kolnai. he was disappointed. After thought, he revised the interest of this author, and he decided boldly that it was better not to publish the paper because the subject was not worth. And maybe it was connected with a discovery of the consistence of this issue of, let's say, a pseudo-religion or anti-religious religion, which were fascism, communism, and Nazism, as not reducible to the dialectics of religion and individualism. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, I was going just to take up the same observations and just ring into that from a slightly different angle, which in his work, Emile tended to refer to these secular religions not as such, but I think as political messianism, which is, so it was a very particular kind of religion that these political movements were emulating, and I think his objection to it was, well, obviously there are many objections to these movements, but in particular he felt that what was going on, I think, was that, as it were, this was a classic example of the state or of politics trespassing into that area where its antennae were no longer functioning, but that this was very much a response to the void of pouvoir spirituel that was there. So in one sense it becomes part of the evidence of the problem, as well as a very clearly dead-end solution.
Thank you. Do we have more questions and comments? Yeah.
It seems often with conversations with Emile, we always end up on grand
themes. I mean, it seemed often we end up talking about the nature of politics and political activity and what that meant. So I guess this is a question for Chris. And so in your Trinity, right, you have liberals, you have the Christians, and you have the Marxists. So this maybe a question that's perhaps in the spirit of our conversations that we used to have. Do Marxists really have a theory of politics? So what I mean by politics here is of normal politics, the day-to-day of politics, the politics of ordinary life, not revolutionary politics. You might say, well, the later Marxists had a theory of the party, but it was the vanguard, it was the revolutionary party, or they had a theory of revolution, perhaps, but not of ordinary politics, not the slow boring of hard wars. And that's what the liberals had, and that's what the Christians had. The Christians had institutional forms of the church, theories of the church, and so on. And obviously, liberals had parliaments. But what about Marxists?
Yes, I might want to quibble about whether liberals and Christians do have coherent and consistent and widely shared views of the day-to-day activity of politics. I think you could probably drive some wedges into that thought too. But yes, I more or less agree with the thought about the Marxists that Marxism is weak on politics, especially the kind of politics you describe. There's a big reason for that, which is that on Marx's account, politics is largely an epiphenomenal activity. It's on the classic, rather crude version of historical materialism. It belongs to the superstructure rather than the substructure. But I think there's something that's a bland thought. But I think there's, it's quite interesting that. There's a remark of Althusser somewhere, Louis Althusser, the post-war French communist, who said something like, who has really built Marxist political theorist? I can only think of Antonio Gramsci. And Gramsci's prison notebooks have often been described as the Marxist theory of politics, or the missing account of the kind of politics, day-to-day activity you describe. But I think as we can now read Gramsci, Gramsci became a classic text where the people who were reading him as his works became available in after the Second World War in particular, in Italy, but not just in Italy, among the New Left, among postmodernists and poststructuralists. Gramsci's prison notebooks were the classic text, I think, where people found what they were looking for in it. Because people read it in a decontextualized, in a very unhistorical way. People had this, and these are difficult, suggestive texts, but people often did, I think, find exactly what they were looking for, and a lot of people opened up the books looking for the missing Marxist theory of politics. I'm actually quite sympathetic to the sceptical thought underpinning your question. Marxist political movements of all kinds have had a self-understanding that on some level this is a project about abolishing politics, and if that's your project, you may have a problem coming up with a convincing and persuasive account that takes politics on its own terms. So I think there's a lot to be got out of a careful reading of Gramsci, but as especially my former colleague in Oxford, Peter Ghosh, showed in a magnificent article that he published in the journal History of European Ideas, called Gramscian Hegemony, an absolutist historicist approach. I can't remember the exact title, but he shows brilliantly that this book is not what people have taken it to be, and I think that's right, that people have projected an awful lot onto this text, but one of the reasons they have is because it is very difficult to fashion a Marxist theory of politics, and lots of people want to find one and they don't. If you did want a Marxist book on politics, the work of Ralph Miliband Sr., so the father of David and Edward, as the joke...
Hang on.
As, Well, as the joke goes, Ralph Miliband devoted his career to expounding the theory that the British Labour Party had nothing to offer the working class, and his sons are devoting theirs to proving it. I think probably Ralph Miliband's works are about as good as you can get in Marxist political thought.
Well, I would like to add a few words in defence of not Marxist politics, but the idea of a Marxist conception of politics. There is one, in fact, which is class struggle. The only problem with Marxism, of course, it has its weakness. First weakness, a theory of revolutionary politics as destruction of politics itself does not dispose to understanding of ordinary politics. But after all, Marx had this idea of class struggle. The only problem is Marxists never realized that it's simply the same view of politics as that of liberals. Because before Marx, class struggle was the idea of politics of Guizot, of Adam Smith, and even before him, Machiavel. The contrast between I Grandi and the people, after all, there is a Marxist idea of politics, but not original and not self-conscious.
Do we have some more? If we could take two or three points, if people have them, and then we could, since it's already 5 to 7.
Yeah. Of the various religious groups as set against the state or against politics. And it seemed as though the way that you were characterizing these groups is that they would in some way be this, provide a missing source of virtue or values and ethics of some sort. And I was wondering if those groups would necessarily need to be religious or characterized as religious, or there would be other kinds of ethical groups or virtuous groups, just whether you were equating the religious with the, say, concern for ethics and virtue.
Annulling the procedure just proposed, I do apologise. I tried, but for time didn't spell out too broadly to say religious and non-religious groups at one point, in that I would entirely take the point, and I believe that Emile would as well, that there is no monopoly on ethical thinking or ethical values in religious groups, but the concept of spiritual power, I think, was which Emile draws from a number of thinkers, Gandhi, Peggy, Maitre, Comte, all sorts of people, is an extremely broad one and not as narrowly sectarian as perhaps I am prone to make it sound.
I guess if religion should not be reduced to individual faith, as most secularists would want it to be, it really historically has been one of the most important idioms for sociability, which Christopher mentioned. But I feel there is a tendency towards metaphysicalizing religion in the discussion, this dependence on the divine and things like that. So what's republicanism's answer to sociability if it usually is against all kinds of particularisms, especially religious?
If there are any more, since we're running out of time, if anyone has anything else they'd like to say before we take that question. Okay, that's a good general question to...
I think probably different republicanisms say different things. The engagement with... The thought that about the importance of religion pulsates through the tradition from Machiavelli's argument about a civil religion somehow modelled on the Roman paganism through to Rousseau's discussion of the civil religion at the end of the social contract. And then we can go through the politics of the French Revolution and the Robespierreist cult of the supreme being. religion comes in again and again and again, but I don't know that there is a, I don't know there's a general answer to the question, Republicanism is an extraordinarily broad and varied and a rich tradition of political thought, and I would hesitate to generalize too much, but it's a terribly important issue.
It's far too big a question for me to deal with, but I can, as it were, give something, I think, of a response that Emile might have given, because I've learned it from him. And I think what you're getting at would be summed up for him in the life of Charles Peguy, the French Republican Catholic mystic, if you like, who would say the problem, I mean, in a sense, is precisely as you've expressed it, and that, you know, republics can come up with what Peggy would call a mystique, some means of making people look outside themselves, but that the one of the particular dangers that the modern world has faced since the rise of industrial capitalism has been precisely the disintegration and the inward lookingness of persons towards just a particular and personal objective. So it's not much of an answer, but I think Emile sympathises with the sense that the Republic can elicit loyalty, but it has to be a very particular thing. It's not republicanism, perhaps, so much as this Republic or that Republic, with its own historical tradition through time, that can, as in America, I think, generate a sort of identity to which people are loyal. But that if that identity becomes itself monolithic, it starts to become the kind of thing to which people are no longer loyal and are merely enslaved, which is a very different thing.
You don't say anything by way of conclusion. Well, then, I would like to thank our three speakers very much for that fascinating discussion, which I think is very much in the spirit of Emile and shows what a rich legacy his thought has left us, and also thank the audience for their contribution. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's round this evening off. Cambridge is a place where at any one time on a weekday evening, there are about 25 other events going on, quite apart from the normal business of teaching and work. And the number of people here tonight says one thing. Another is that we've been listening to the articulation of big ideas and very important themes. And nearly everybody here knew Emile in one way or another. And I'm sure that they have gone through something of the experience that I myself have gone through tonight. First of all, I have heard Emile. Emile didn't talk to me about any of these things. I didn't think I'd understand them, probably. But I nevertheless hear his voice. And secondly, in my mind's eye, I have been thinking all evening, I have an image of Emile in my mind. And the fact that that's been achieved, and probably for many of you too, is part of our debt to David and his panel, and to, you know, people who've come from France and have busy lives. They've come here to pay tribute to Emile, and we're extremely grateful for everybody who's been involved in this evening. Thank you very much.